The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Book of Serenity, case number 21. Yunyan sweeps the grounds. When Yunyan was sweeping the grounds, Dao Wu said, "You're working hard, aren't you?" Yunyan said, "You should know that there is one who does not work hard." "Is that so? You mean there is a second moon?" Yunyan raised his bamboo broom and asked, "How many moons is this?" Dao Wu was silent. Xuan Sha said later, "That is exactly the second moon." Yun Men said later, "The manservant greets the maidservant politely." So this koan is from Tang Dynasty, China, as are many of our koans. This one is from the Book of Serenity, sometimes called the Book of Equanimity. And it concerns two monks, two Zen practitioners, Yun Yan and Dao Wu, who both would later become important teachers. But in this story, they are studying still with their teacher, Yao Shan, another great Chinese Zen or Chan teacher. And Yun Yan and Dao Wu are especially known for their great Dharma friendship, for being wonderful model Dharma siblings. And so we learn something about what it means to be a Dharma friend from the koans concerning Yunyan and Dao Wu. And one of the things we learn, evidently, is that being a good Dharma friend includes some testing and teasing, because they like to do this with each other. Not in the way of really some of the really harsh Dharma combats we get in some other koans, but there's something more like a gentle, loving sibling rivalry that comes out for me in the koans about them. So in this koan, significantly, I think, it begins with a scene of work. Earlier this morning, I mentioned the Japanese term samu, which means work practice. And we all did some work practice during our home practice period this morning. And although this is a Japanese term, samu, the practice goes way back to China, nearly to the beginnings of Chan, of Zen in China. And this emphasis on work practice is in real contrast to what had come to China from India. In Indian Buddhism, work was avoided, and monks lived by begging for alms. They did not do anything like farming, because working was seen as generating karma, and they were trying to free themselves from karma. And we can see certain problems maybe in that attitude. Certainly when Zen came to China, or rather when Buddhism came to China and Zen developed out of the coming together of Indian Buddhism and Chinese traditions, especially Taoism, when Chan or Chinese Zen emerged, the only way that the mountain monasteries really could survive was by doing agriculture, was by engaging in some farming. A lot of the monasteries were way up in the mountains, too far from villages and people, no one to beg from. So work was honored. And this is an important feature of Zen that I'm not sure always gets enough emphasis, that manual labor is very much a form of practice, or can be, that manual labor is very much honored. And this comes up a lot in the tradition, including in this koan. So here is Yunyan doing his samu, doing his work practice, sweeping the grounds. And Dao Wu sees him And perhaps thinks that Yunyan is going at it just a little too hard. Yunyan is maybe making a bit of a display of his work, or maybe Yunyan is in a hurry to finish up. In this translation that we use, Da Wu says, "You're working hard, aren't you?" In other translations, Da Wu says, "Too hurried," or "Too busy." So Da Wu sees something a little excessive in Yunyan. This is not limited to Zen contexts. When I was a young man working in the Seattle shipyards, if you were working in a hurried, busy way, you would be reproached by other laborers who would usually use the phrase, "Hey, what you doing, buddy? Bucking for foreman?" Because if you worked too fast, you made everybody else look like they were working too slow. And maybe there's just a bit of this in the koan. Da Wu thinks that Yunyan is making a bit of a display of his work practice, that he's bucking for foreman, that he's bucking for Roshi, maybe. And so Da Wu teases him a little. You're working hard, aren't you? But maybe something else going on too. Maybe he sees Yunyan a little too single-mindedly, a little too robustly practicing Zen, doing his work practice, as though he believes that he can make something happen through this work. I'm suggesting that maybe Da Wu sees Yunyan's activity here as a version of polishing the tile to make it into a mirror, right? From another of our Zen stories, where a Zen practitioner is caught doing Zazen when everyone else is asleep. And his future teacher says, this is actually Matsu, and his future teacher says to him, "Why are you doing Zazen?" And Matsu says, "To become a Buddha." And so the teacher starts polishing a tile, and Matsu says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Making this a mirror." And Matsu says, "Yeah, you can't polish a tile into a mirror." Right, right. So is Yunyan polishing a tile here in working so hard, working so single-mindedly? So Yunyan replies, "You should know that there's one who does not work hard." And sometimes we talk about a koan having a kind of kernel, called in Chinese, it's wado. To me, this is the kernel of the koan. Who is the one, I might sit with it this way, who is the one who does not work hard when we're engaged in our work practice, when we're engaged in our life practice, when we're doing anything? Who is the one who is still? Who is the one who is not busy? Who is the one who's in no hurry? You should know that there's one who does not work hard. This is something to, I think, really sit with over this weekend, over our retreat together, as we do our sitting practice and maybe work a little at that, as we do our home practice and engage in some of our normal caretaking activities. Where is the still point? Where is the one? Who is the one who all this time is, to go back to the title of this koan collection, who's the one who is serene? Who is the one who is not taken up in the moment? So this is Yunyan's wonderful reply. You should know there's one who does not work hard. But Da Wu is not going to let Yunyan off easy. The Dharma dialogue has not yet ended. And so he comes back at Yunyan with this. Is that so? You mean there's a second moon? In another translation, In that case, is there a second moon? And this too, maybe I was a little hasty in talking about where the kernel of the koan was, because now this one becomes the kernel of the koan for me. Maybe this koan, like some nuts, has two kernels. Is there a second moon? Really going to the heart of the paradoxical, difficult heart of Zen. Sometimes we put it this way. This is from a verse by Wu Men. Is this one? Is this two? We recited together a little while ago, all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. So are ice and water one thing or two things? Are beings and Buddha one thing or two things? And we also read Menju by Dogen, where he says, this is a splendid opportunity for Buddha Dharma to enter into mud and water. Mud and we talk about the lotus growing out of mud and water. We talk about awakening growing out of the mud and water of our ordinary lives, of the dust of this world. Dust is sometimes a name in Zen for the world of phenomena, for the 10,000 things. But if this is a splendid opportunity for Buddha Dharma to enter into mud and water, and it is, does that mean Buddha Dharma wasn't already in mud and water? Where was it before? What were the mud and water before Buddha Dharma entered? Are there two moons? Is there a second moon? This is a perplexing question. And a second question we can sit with over the course of our retreat. And then you can only love Yunyan's answer. Yunyan raised his bamboo broom, the broom he's been sweeping with, and asked, how many moons is this? I love the spirit behind this. And I love the gesture of raising the broom. In some koans, the teacher will raise the hosu, which is the fly whisk. And I think that Yunyan is kind of modeling that with the broom. Now, instead of this fancy ornamental fly whisk with its horsehair, there's just this humble broom with its straw sticking out in every direction. And yet, that's it. That's it right now. How many moons is this? Or in other translations, which moon is that? Which moon could it be? So what is your broom at this moment? What is the broom that you hold up? What is your broom when you're sitting? What is your broom when you're washing the dishes? What is your broom when you're feeding the dog or cat? Which broom is this? Which moon is this? This is a great pointer for all of us. Raising the broom. Dao Wu was silent. Something I love about this sibling rivalry in Dao Wu and Yunyan, they so much come off as Dharma siblings that a couple of Zen writers who you would think would know better say that they're biological brothers. They're not, but they come off that way. They really have this wonderful relationship, and it's quite different from the relationship in a lot of koans, which is teacher and student, or, you know, where there are Dharma combats, two rival teachers, each of which thinks they're superior in their understanding to the other. You don't get that with Dao Wu and Yunyan. I looked at a few of the koans about them. And in one of them, Yunyan calls Dao Wu elder brother. Dawu was a little bit older, at least according to Zen's Chinese heritage, than Yunyan. But in another koan, Dawu calls Yunyan elder brother. Which one is the more senior practitioner? Maybe they take turns playing this role. And so Yunyan, at the beginning of this koan, Dawu plays the role of teacher, challenging Yunyan. You're working hard, aren't you? But what's all this busyness? What's all this frenetic activity? What's this about? And towards the end of the koan, Yunyan plays the teacher, raising his broom as though he's raising the hosu, as though he's raising this fly wisp, which is a symbol, one of the symbols of the teacher's authority. And Dawu was silent. Dawu does not further engage. There's some kind of acknowledgement there. Sometimes the silence in a koan is a silence of just not knowing what to say next. Maybe it's a silence of feeling defeated or shut down. I don't think that this is this kind of silence. I think this silence is a silence of acknowledgement. And I like to think of Dawu not just being silent, but smiling, and Yunyan smiling, and both of them almost on the verge of bursting into laughter. That's how it strikes me. And we have a couple of comments that come later. This becomes a story that bounces around through the tradition. And before it gets written down in Book of Serenity, there have been various comments on them. Swan Shah says later, that's exactly the second moon. We might say adding frost to snow, teasing us a little further. And Yun Men said still later, the manservant greets the maidservant politely. I will not comment on these comments, but perhaps Melissa will tomorrow. So thank you. Let me read the koan to you one last time. Book of Serenity, case 21. Yunyan sweeps the grounds. When Yunyan was sweeping the grounds, Dawu said, you're working hard, aren't you? Yunyan said, you should know there's one who does not work hard. Is that so? You mean there's a second moon? Yunyan raised his bamboo broom and asked, how many moons is this? Dawu was silent. Swan Sha said later, that is exactly the second moon. Yun Men said later, the manservant greets the maidservant politely. So we'll now move into Dharma dialogue. And please sit comfortably. We'll come forward with whatever is coming up, whether it's related in any obvious way or subtle way to the koan or not, whatever's coming up for you this morning, whatever is touching you. And please raise your Zoom hand so that I can call on you. And David and Melissa will also help answer your questions or respond to your comments. And we already have a couple of hands. How wonderful. Joanne.
Thank you so much for the talk, Alan. What came up for me, is this effect that I have in my life on a regular basis of that I'm forgetting something, or I have to go do something, or and it's gotten a little more magnified since I've been watching my grandson. There's this sense of like, wait, is Adrian here? Like, and this, I'm not saying I know exactly why that happens, but I know that I've really beat the bush to myself for years, to my detriment health-wise, mentally and physically, And it's just really so refreshing to hear this today. Yeah, that's all.
Yeah, thank you, Joanne. And I also want to say, you know, I remember from being father of very young children, I remember that feeling so well, especially if I was with one of my kids in a public space and I would lose sight of them for a second. And there would be a moment really of terror, you know, where's Nate? Where's Lita? Where are they? And this is, I think, something that's good. You know, this is a sign of your love for your grandchild. And then, you know, so important as soon as you spot the grandchild, not to then project that moment of terror, of anxiety onto the child and infect the child with it. So yeah, a really good opportunity to find that still space to remember that there's one who was never worried. There was one who always knew that the child was right there. Yeah, what a lovely way to respond. Thanks, Joanne.
And you know, just to add one more thing, Joanne, this is related to some of our feedback to comments last night about people's intentions. You can have an intention of being really focused and not getting distracted and not, you know, keeping the story going, as Alan's pointing to. But before you do that, to appreciate it, Alan just gave you a pointer that maybe saying it's bad is off base. Maybe it just is what it is, the loving heart of a grandmother, or with everything in your life that you forget about or walk into a room and think, what am I doing here? And all those things that some of us can really relate to as we get older. So just to appreciate, you know, in the sense of not, oh, this is great, but to just see through the, oh, this is bad side of things and be really interested in this particular pattern that you keep enacting. This is something very familiar, and it's part of the Buddha nature entering mud and water. It isn't a mistake. Yeah. Thank you.
Barry.
Thank you for the talk. The talk took me to age 16 when I started my first job in a suitcase factory. And it was in a poor area of a city. And my coworkers spoke Spanish. They were Puerto Rican or French Canadian. And it was quite an eye opener for me. And I would, my first few days on the job, I was rushing around trying to prove what a great worker I was. And they told me to slow down. And at first I thought they were afraid I was going to show them up. But then I figured out it was compassionate advice. I needed to pace myself in order to get through the 7 to 3 days in the suitcase factory when it was 90 degrees. Mm. So they weren't in fact threatened. They were actually being kindly. And anyway, that's where I went with this interesting story. And just to say the obvious, well, there are two moons when it's reflected in the lake.
Well, are there, Barry?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like this other way of talking about, you know, about friendship and siblings, work friendship, work siblings. And yet, I'm not sure that Dao Wu was worried that Yunyan was going to burn himself out sleeping. But maybe he was worried that Yunyan was going to burn himself out trying to be a really, really good Zen student. Yeah, so good pointer again for all of us.
And I think of all of these voices that come to us, sometimes from the outside, hey, kid, slow down a little bit. And as Joanne said, the voices that come from the inside. We have many Dharma friends and relationships within ourself that come up, and some are quite nice and gentle, like Dawu and Yunyan, and some are quite severe and mean. But I love Barry pointing to the possibility that maybe some compassionate intention, even behind the voices that seem harsh, maybe beneath that harshness is something for us to learn and grow from. Yeah, thanks.
Marla.
Oh, thank you. That was a really well-timed talk for me. Thank you so much. I realized in the last couple of months that I used to be able to live at a slower pace. And I used to get tremendous enjoyment on slow days out of reading international cookbooks. I would read about Japanese food or Persian food, and I'd learn and I'd imagine, and it was wonderful. And then I went into a profession which arguably, you know, pays our bills, and that's great. But overwork can be a badge of honor, and burnout can be a badge of honor. And I went a little too far down that path. But today I went into my morning samu and breakfast period, and I thought, you know, I'm going to be really mindful. And I ended up irritated because I wanted to vacuum and do all of the laundry and sort through all of the old t-shirts in 2 hours while also showering. And you know what? I think I can have awareness, but I guess I didn't get the message as well. But your talk gave me the message again, like those t-shirts could be another time too. So thank you.
I just feel like handing you a tile to polish. You know, but these, again, this pattern, you did give me a tile, it's up on the mantle. These patterns of shaping our lives in certain ways that are very grounded in some way that in the past worked for us. And then they become unknown in a way to our conscious mind. In what happened to you this morning and sharing it with everybody, I recognize that same mindset, and it's, you might say, again, if you're going into positive and negative, it's a delusion, but it isn't. It was a useful way of living your life, and this morning it wasn't useful, but you could see it. You could see it enacting itself. And that's what Zen for me is really about, this clear seeing. Changing behavior comes next, but you don't really do it. You start to see through it. And that's very powerful. You're not even in charge of your own transformation. Like, not at all. You're only in charge of being awake to these patterns that are not useful anymore. I used to teach with somebody who used the metaphor of stop putting on the shoes you had when you were two. They don't fit anymore, right? So get new shoes. But before you do that, you have to kind of say, whoa, I can't even get my heel in this. What's going on? And that what's going on is the same spirit as the two characters in this story, challenging each other. That's what we do with each other in Zen. We challenge each other to not buy into these old patterns. So we can do that internally and also like this externally. This is the community of awakening to what's actually so.
Will.
Thank you very much for the talk on. I guess I thought I would speak just because my sort of a slightly different thing that's coming up for me. The tile that I'm polishing is one that it really isn't turning into a mirror, but I'm polishing hard. And it's rather odd for me. So I thought I would just air it. And that is that I actually seem to have entered a phase of life where I keep intending to, I have very strong intentions to do a work. You know, if I say, for example, that, you know, it's something like writing, right? You've got a blank screen. And I think to myself, in the first thing in the morning, oh, I'm going to do a lot of work. And then I have this feeling that, oh, this is good. Here I am getting ready to work, and I'm working, or I'm building up to working or something. And then I notice it's evening somehow. So there's something going on. And I almost feel as though, looking back, like, I think in some sense, I've always had a kind of somebody evading work. That's my other moon, maybe. Someone who thinks, reassuring myself I'm doing work. But I think I used to be unhappier about it, and it made me actually get more done. whereas now I feel, you know, maybe the serenity has become a little bit disabling, that I feel pretty good not working. I feel that I want to keep that. So I'm dealing with two moons that are just a little bit different, it seems to me, from what was going on in the koan. So I just thought I would throw that out.
I'm reminded of the movie Dodgeball, one of the great classics, cinematic classics of our time. And there's a gym in that, the bad guy's gym, and their advertisement is, "When will you hate yourself enough to come work out with us?" and I do think that in our culture, the great fear is that if I'm not critical, if I don't hate myself enough, if I don't whip myself up into a frenzy, I won't be able to get anything done. Mm-hmm. I appreciate what you're saying. You're looking into this, as we all are, this great matter of ourself. Someone was talking about going into the mystery, I think Pierce last night. So what a mystery. And if you don't suffer, will you not do any work? As I'm recovering from my accident, I'm trying to sleep. And I think, if I don't push myself, will I still get better? And where is that line of stepping through into something that may be uncomfortable? And when is it wait and see? And maybe I don't want to write. Looking into that. But it gets quite real and complicated, as you're pointing out. It's not like, oh, great, I feel wonderful and I'm never going to do anything anymore. What is the middle way here? Yeah.
I wanted to comment too, Will, that I remember this pattern that you're talking about so well, because for me to write, it usually meant that I had to have a deadline, and then I had to let the deadline get closer and closer and closer until there was just enough time to do what had to be done. And I needed to get the anxiety up to this, you know, almost boiling point. And then I would throw myself into it. And it was really not a great way to be. And then I think it was partly the Zen practice helped me do this. Maybe it was just a coincidence. But then there was a time when I would wake up and I would have that, you know, thought that you talked about, well, I'm going to write today. And I would sit down and write a sentence. And it didn't have to be a lot. You know, I would start. When I look at the floor and it's dirty, I don't think I'm going to have to sweep it later. I pick up the broom, speaking of the broom. So there's that possibility too, to just cut out all of the middle stuff and just do what wants to be done at the moment that it wants to be done. Easy for me to say, I know.
And I also want to comment on it. It's such a wonderful question that you ask, Will, and so relevant to what it means to be human. I think, and I really appreciate what David and Alan just said. The thought that came up while you were talking was actually, it's in two parts. Let me see if I can articulately say this. The pandemic has been a bit challenging for me. I don't know if that's true for anybody else. Lots of stuff has happened also. Six people close to me have died since last December, a year ago December. And meanwhile, I had been asked to write a chapter for a book about Zen. And I was noticing that somehow I couldn't get to it at all. And I tried to weasel my way out of it even, and the editor wouldn't let me. But then I finally said, whenever I would sit in front of the computer, and this is where my Zen practice really comes in, I would feel how unimportant it was to my life to write this chapter, and that there were other things that were more important, my family, my practice, my friends, my teaching. It was actually getting in the way in a certain way of what I really love to do. So I finally just wrote to the guy and said, I'm out. Don't try to talk me out of it again. And then, thank goodness, because then the fall, 2 months ago, I had a head injury. David just had his car accident, and then my brother died unexpectedly. I'm so happy that I'm not writing that chapter, which would now be in its final stages. And the word deadline is very apt for these things. I always remember, you know, writing things at the last minute. Going back to elementary school, I think it's always been part of my life. And this what is important question has been really up for me. And now that we're in this state of like, what is important? It feels really important to be here right now, talking to you, for example. That's the most important thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And when I get up in the morning, I also have my list of things to do. At the end of the day, I got the dishes done. It's really flipped around. And this koan is all about flipping these things around too. Alan kept showing us that. So this is allowing our lives to be flipped over and over and over. And again, the same theme about watching what's really arising moment after moment. Thanks.
Thank you.
Jordan.
Thank you for the talk. It's really catalyzed something volcanic in me. I think a lot about labor and work. It's a central theme in my thinking in life. And I mean, as a labor organizer, I was the person telling people, like, there's somebody that doesn't work hard, because I see people equate like the value of themselves, like with the work they do, with the effort they do, and then they work themselves to death, to near death. They make these huge sacrifices and they hurt people around them in order to work harder. And they're told to do that. It's not just them. They're told to work harder, not less. And to the detriment of what feels like everybody. And that it infuriates me. But also, I know that I don't know best and I can't change them. And so there's this position of these two moons of me and them and my thinking and theirs, and they're connected. I can't ignore them. We have a relationship, but I also, I'm not them. And just sitting in the volcanic place of all that.
Yeah, thanks, Jordan. You reminded me, I mentioned working in the shipyards when I was young, and there was a joke about that Social Security was kind of a joke, because a lot of the older guys, there were younger women working then in the shipyards, but all the old people were men. And the older guys would finally retire. They'd be sort of forced out. They'd just be too sore to work again. And then they would die without that work, even though the work was almost crippling. Without the work, they would have nothing to live for. And so the joke was that you would never get Social Security as a working class person. And there was some truth to that. So how to detach the feeling of who you are from the feeling from the job that you do, how to make work something that is an activity but not an identity. And all I could say, Jordan, is to when people are out of work, to encourage them to enjoy it, you know, reassure them that they'll be back in work, but enjoy it while they're not. Hard to do though, if the system has led you to believe that your value is entirely what you produce and not who you are.
And I might just add a couple of words here too, Jordan, about your job is never to change other people, right? You can only aim towards your own heart, mind. And in that healing, that has a reverberating effect on other people. But we're not here to fix people. We can't do it. It's offensive to most people. We are here, however, to go deeply into our own experience of life and find the way to, as Alan said, to be in serenity with whatever it is, busyness, grief, pain. How do you face your life directly?
Anne.
Yeah, I feel like I'm coming from a totally different place because I kept thinking the broom is also a moon and that I have often loved to work. And maybe he was working hard because he enjoyed it. And there's jobs I've done where I don't like having a deadline. I don't like feeling I have to do this. I like having lots of time and thinking I can keep going for as long as this gives me pleasure, which in gardens is a very long time and at jobs getting cut off. But always defining work as something negative, as something that is, for many people, it is imposed. I'm from working class family. I don't want to be light of this. But for many people, it's wonderful. It's being with other people who are doing the same thing. It's all the camaraderie. It's supporting your family. It's making the garden bloom. I've loved working in my life.
Well, and I think this is what the one who was sweeping was saying. So maybe he was sweating. Maybe it was a hot day and he was sweating and someone comes and say, wow, you're really working hard. But he, like you, was in the garden. He was tending to the ground that he loved. He was having a wonderful time. And I love this theme of putting things on their head. So we say, well, work is bad. Don't work hard. It's wonderful to work hard, to give ourselves to what we love, to get down and dirty with the garden or to be with other people. And I think when we find our truest work, there can be a joy in spending ourselves, spending our life toward what is most alive. Then this work and play, these words don't really fit. There's some other full engagement beyond hard or easy, two moons or one moon. We just hold the trowel up in our dirty little hand, right?
And even saying, I agree with everything you're saying, except how you began. I don't think you're in a different place than many of us. I love my work. I'm sorry that didn't come across when I was talking, but I don't love everything I have to do. And so part of this is about seeing how can I fully engage with my life in whatever form it takes. And that's the encouragement in Zen. One part of the Eightfold Path, the way of practice, is right livelihood. The word right is sama in Pali, and it means aligned with your livelihood. So this is a very important part of the way. Thank you.
Paul.
Yes, such a rich dialogue. I really appreciate it. Everything's coming up as far as for me. And one thing that that I'm finding is that I keep hearing the ghost of our evening gata as far as speaking to me. This idea of, you know, don't squander your life. You know, particularly echoes, Melissa, when you were sharing as far as how this last year and around the book chapter, and this idea of really discerning, you know, how to spend that life. I think this is what, as far as Alan and Melissa were encouraging us to, investigate as far as last night is what I feel, and another line that keeps coming up to me, and I attribute it to you, Melissa, you can disavow it if you want, but these are the early stages during the Center for Mindfulness, this aspect of, you know, there's never enough time. There's never enough time. And there's always just the right amount of time. And I think it is through this discernment, don't squander your life. You know, how are we going to show up? How are we going to engage? I really, really appreciate that reminder in Alan, your talk just really hit that for me, and the dialogue has opened it up. So thank you.
And perhaps we could use a new translation of the ghost. Sure. We could use Mary Oliver's wonderful lines. Instead of do not squander your life, we might say, tell me, what is it you plan to do with your right. one wild and precious life this evening?
Yeah, lovely.
I think captures that spirit.
Oh, one of the things that's been really healing for me over these last few weeks is the last conversation I had with my brother, even though we didn't know he was going to die, but it was a wonderful conversation, partly because he said, I just want you to know, I really want you to know, honey, that I've had a wonderful life. Mm. And it's been full of adventure. And he was a publisher on, you know, lived on Park Avenue in New York City, and he owned a car repair shop. And he just had so many different identities as a working person. But he really loved everything he did. That was part of his spirit. And I just keep remembering that. What a model, right? I never heard him complain except when people treated him badly. And then he would look into, how can I get out of this and do something else? So yeah. Thanks for reminding me of that. That keeps echoing in my mind. I had a wonderful life.
And while we're on retreat together, we can love doing nothing as well.
Yes.
Thank you, Paul. Pierce.
Thanks, Alan. You mentioned the paradoxical heart of Zen, and I've been grappling with the sense that there is a paradox in Zen, although I've been told that there isn't. And that it's all in here. But at any rate, two things that I appreciate about the talk. One is the encouragement to ask the question, who is the one, which I find especially useful or evocative. You know, and the way I ask it sometimes is, who is the one who is falling asleep, or who is the one who is dim and dull? And there may be an element of reproach in that, but your suggestion points to a more open-ended way of using that. And of course, you know, if I think there's an answer, then that is a mistake. The other thing that I loved about your talk is that you've given me a new insight into how koans work. And I realized that in spite of this wonderful Dharma dialogue, there is no other way to communicate what is in that koan except through this little dialogue that these two Dharma brothers have. There's no other way. And as much as I appreciate the Dharma dialogue and all that we have been saying, this is what I'm taking away from your talk. So thank you.
Thank you, Pierce. Right. So the best way to talk about the koan is to read it again.
Which we'll do tomorrow. I think maybe right. This is our
Why don't we end here and we'll look forward to more work with this koan and more play with this koan. Thank you, everybody.